Seth Duncan was at his father's kitchen table, opposite the old man himself, elbow to elbow with his Uncle Jonas on one side and his Uncle Jasper on the other. The four men were still and subdued because they weren't alone in the room. Roberto Cassano was there, leaning on the sink, and Angelo Mancini was there, leaning on the door. Cassano had made a point of smoothing his shirt into the waistband of his pants, even though it was already immaculate, and Mancini had opened his coat and pressed the heels of his hands into the small of his back, as if it was aching from driving. But really, both men's gestures had been designed to show off their pistols in their shoulder holsters. The pistols were Colt Double Eagles, stainless steel semi-automatics, a matched pair. The Duncans had seen the weapons and gotten the point, and so they were sitting quiet and saying nothing. Cassano said,
"Tell me again. Explain it to me. Convince me. How is this stranger disrupting the shipment?"
Jacob Duncan said,
"Do I tell your boss how to run his business?"
"I guess not.
Because it's his business.
Presumably, it has a thousand subtleties that I don't fully understand, so I stay well out of it."
"And Mr. Rossi stays well out of your business, until he gets inconvenienced."
"He's welcome to find an alternative source. I'm sure he will. But right now there's a live contract."
"We'll deliver."
"When?"
"As soon as this stranger is out of our hair."
Cassano just shook his head in frustration. Mancini said,
"You guys need to change your tactics. The stranger was in the fields, okay, no question. But now he's not anymore. He's back in the truck he took from those two donkeys last night. He had it stashed somewhere. You should be looking for it. You should be checking the roads again."
Seth Duncan's Cadillac was new enough to have all the bells and whistles, but old enough to be a straight-up turnpike cruiser. It wasn't competing against BMW and Mercedes-Benz for yuppie money like the current models were. It was competing against planes and trains for long-distance comfort, like traditional full-boat caddies always had. Reacher liked it a lot. It was a fine automobile. It was long and wide and weighed about 2 tons. It was smooth and silent. It was relaxed. It was a one-finger, one-toe kind of car, designed for sprawling. It had black paint and black leather and black glass, and a warm-toned radio and a three-quarters full tank of gas. Reacher had got in it and racked its seat back and eased it out of the garage, and Kate turned it behind the house and nosed it cautiously back to the two-lane. He had turned left, south, and wafted on down the road in a rolling cocoon of calm and quiet. The landscape didn't change at all. Straight road ahead, dirt to the right, dirt to the left, clouds overhead. He saw no other traffic. 10 miles south of where he started, there was an old roadhouse standing alone in the weedy remnant of a beaten earth parking lot. It was closed down and boarded up, with a bad roof and ancient Pabst Blue Ribbon and Miller High Life signs on the walls, barely visible behind layers of mud. After that, there was nothing, all the way to the horizon. Roberto Cassano stepped out of Jacob Duncan's back door and walked across weedy gravel to where he couldn't be overheard. A thin plume of black smoke rose far to the north, the burned-out truck still smoldering, the stranger's work. Cassano dialed his cell and got Rossi after 3 rings. He said,
"They're sticking to their story, boss. We're not going to get the shipment until they get the stranger."
Rossi said, "That makes no sense.
Tell me about it. It's Alice in Wonderland."
"How much pressure have you applied?"
"To the Duncans themselves?"
"That's my next question. How much pressure do you want us to apply?"
There was a long pause, with a breath like a sigh resigned. Rossi said, "The problem is, they sell great stuff. I won't find better. I won't find anything half as good. So I can't burn them, because I'm going to need them again in the future. Over and over, no question about that. So? So, play their game. Find the damn stranger." The doctor stepped out of Eleanor Duncan's door and stared hard at the pickup truck. He didn't want to get in it, didn't want to drive it, didn't want to be seen with it, didn't want to be anywhere near it. It was a Duncan vehicle. It had been misappropriated, and the manner of its misappropriation had been a major humiliation for the Duncans. Two Cornhuskers tossed aside contemptuously. Therefore, to be involved with the truck in any way at all would be an outrageous provocation, insane. He would be punished, severely and forever. But he was a doctor, and sober, unfortunately, therefore clear-headed. He had patients. He had responsibilities. To Vincent at the motel, for one, to Dorothy the housekeeper, for another, both were shaken up. And he was a married man. His wife was 8 miles away, scared and alone. He looked at the key in his hand and the truck in the driveway. He mapped out a route in his head. He could park behind Dorothy's house and keep the truck out of sight. He could park on the wrong side of the motel office and achieve the same result. Then he could dump the truck to the north and hike across the fields to home. Total exposure? Maybe 2 miles on minor tracks and 4 on the two-lane road. 10 minutes. That was all. Safe enough. Maybe. He climbed in the cab and started the engine. The anonymous white van was still on Route 3, still in Canada, but it had left British Columbia behind and had entered Alberta. It was making steady progress, heading east, completely unnoticed. Its driver was making no calls. His phone was switched off. The assumption was that cell towers close to the 49th parallel were monitored for activity. Perhaps conversations were recorded and analyzed. Homeland Security departments on both sides of the border had computer programs with sophisticated software. Individual words could trigger alerts. And even without compromising language, an electronic record of where a guy had been and when was always best avoided. For the same reason, all gas purchases were made with cash in the local currency. And at every stop, the driver turned his collar up and pulled his hat down low, in case there were cameras connected to digital recorders or distant control rooms. The van rolled on, making steady progress, heading east. Rossi clicked off the call with Cassano and thought hard for 5 minutes, and then he dialed Saphir, 6 blocks away. He took a breath and held it and asked, "Have you seen better merchandise?" Saphir said, "You don't have to play the salesman. I already fell for your pitch." "And you've always been satisfied, right?" "I'm not satisfied now." "I understand," Rossi said. "But I want to discuss something with you."
"Equals discuss," Saphir said. "We are not equals. I tell, you ask."
"Okay. I want to ask you something. I want to ask you to take a step back and consider something.
For example,
I need this shipment. You need this shipment. Everyone needs this shipment. So I want to ask you to put our differences aside and make common cause. Just for a day or two."
"How?"
"My contacts in Nebraska have a bug up their ass."
"I know all about that," Saphir said. "My men gave me a full report."
"I want you to send them up there to help."
"Send who? Up where?"
"Your men. To Nebraska.
There's no point in having them here in my office. Your interests are my interests, and I'm already working as hard as I can on this. So I'm thinking your guys could go help my guys, and between us we could solve this problem.